Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Elisa Prosperetti. Today, I'll be talking to Professor Laura Grillo about her brand new book, An Intimate Rebuke, Female Genital Power in Ritual and Politics in West Africa. An Intimate Rebuke was published in 2018 by Duke University Press. Laura is affiliated faculty in the Department of Theology at Georgetown University. Her areas of expertise are in comparative religion, the anthropology of religions, women and gender studies, and postcolonial theory. Laura Grillo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be talking to you about An Intimate Rebuke.
And I am too. This book was just such a discovery as I was reading it. And I usually begin by asking interviewees if they can tell me a little bit about their background, which I will. But I think before we get into that, I must ask you the question that is burning for all of the listeners. What is female genital power?
Okay. Good question. So I use the term as in reference to a widespread, ancient and widespread ritual. But I also use it to refer to the principle behind the power to which the women who conduct the ritual appeal. So I really want to begin by talking about what the principle is, and that is this ancient, widely held traditional religious belief that postmenopausal women, these women elders, also known as the mothers, are the living embodiment of the ancestors. So as such, they represent the more ultimate moral authority and the duties to protect the values that are the fundament of society. So these women elders are believed to have an innate spiritual power to enforce those moral mandates, and the seat of that power, their innate embodied power, are the genitalia. And I want to put parenthetically here, I emphasize the genitals as the vulva, the buttocks, the breasts, but especially the vulva, as this the living altar, and the seat, literally, of that power, much as the Akan stool is the seat of power and the altar of that power, the ancestral power. And I say that because it's not the vagina, which I think has been a problem, but I'll get to that later. So for at least five centuries that I was able to trace, the mothers have made this appeal to their genitals to deploy the power to protect the populace. And it's actually a ritual of anti-witchcraft, but it's also an act of spiritual warfare. So this is a very fierce power to which they appeal that has is meant to have true efficacy in the world. So what happens is that in times of social calamity, like epidemics or terrible wars or other threats to the community, the women gather to perform the secret nocturnal rite. They strip naked, they slap their genitals and their breasts, and they curse the violations of the moral order in order to ward off evil. They can even evict death from the village. So some of the principal manifestations, they're smeared in white Kaolin river clay. That's a spiritually potent substance of purification. They wield branches or they're pounding the ground with their old pestles in order to curse evildoers and evict death. And sometimes they bathe their genitals in water and that they use that water as aspersion to lay a trap for witches. And it's taboo, especially for men, to look on the mother's nakedness or to see the rite, which is so potent that those who defy this sanction to look upon the mothers risk death. So, in addition to evicting these unseen forces of evil, they also use their genital power to condemn violations, reprehensible acts in society. So social infractions range from the abuse of an individual woman, or reference to women's genitals as an insult, or a lack of respect for women's rights, or an infringement on the purview of their own business dealings, like the own domain of women's business. And to punish the offending man, they would gather in his compound at night and hurl these curses and beat his roof and sometimes urinate or defecate on his doorstep. So again, very, adamant, the word militaristic, comes to mind. I underscore this because, again, throughout the book, I really try and differentiate between the mothers as these postmenopausal women who are managing this office of power as moral, as vigilant kind of overseers of morality, and motherhood or actual mothers and all that is generally associated, especially by in the West, with motherhood, soft, nurturing, protectors. While these mothers are certainly protectors and nurturing of the protection of the community, they do it in very aggressive ways. And I think one of the other reason I mentioned this early on is that I think that scholars have often puzzled over the aggressive nature of these acts, and certainly the colonists did in Africa when they encountered these things, because it was so unexpected and couldn't really it didn't jive with the view of women's role as meek and mild nurturers. So, these female elders deploy this female genital power, as I said, in these spiritual rites, these secret nocturnal rites, but they also call on their so-called bottom power in the context of daytime public manifestations, often to protest or threaten rulers who are abusing their worldly authority. So this has happened throughout history. In pre-colonial times, the mother's authority would be marshaled to sanction rulers in both senses of the word. They would invest male rulers with the full complement of power by making them symbolically ascribing to them all of the qualities of the mothers of women and of mothers and invest them with some of this moral power so that they could wield their power with moral constraints and wisdom. But the female elders would also come out to check the power of any chiefs or kings or leaders who would be violating the moral mandates or overstepping their power or violating the moral mandates. And they would do that by executing this female genital power as a ritual to condemn them So, and they alone could publicly chastise or and even unseat a ruler. And when they made their veto known through the execution of this right, there was no appeal. So their power is really overarching, even in leadership.
So I think with this kind of description, we can see just how invigorating and exciting this idea is of these fierce yes. moral warriors on behalf right. of the community who don't conform to any expectation that a Westerner, a colonist might come to understand the role of these postmenopausal women in society.
Right.
So right. how did you come to these questions, and how did you arrive at this thesis that this female genital power was the underpinning moral compass of societies around West Africa?
Well, initially, the focus of my research for this book had very little to do, nothing to do with this phenomenon of female genital power. My aim was really much more simple and much more open-ended, too. My aim was to return to Côte d'Ivoire, where I had intimate connections to a family into which I had married. I had been married for almost 12 years to an Ivorian man, and still had those connections there. So I wanted to return there and to witness once again this ritual called Dipri, that I had taken it upon myself to investigate and document when I was first living in Côte d'Ivoire with my husband, and that I eventually had written my master's thesis about at Union Theological Seminary, of all places, years later. So this had by now, my project to go back was now 30 years later after that first initial investigation. And I was interested in, you know, how the ritual had changed over time in the shifting social landscape, where a virulent form of Pentecostal Christianity had done much to demonize and dismantle African traditions. And also in the interim, a civil war had taken place at that time, the first civil war, which had pitted Northern Muslims and Southern Christians against each other and had splintered the country into ethnic factions that were vying for territories, cash crops, and the wealthy metropole. So I wanted to know, how did an indigenous tradition like this still have salience? Or did it, you know, in this globalizing situation? So the ritual Dipri is a very spectacular ritual, and actually many people, tourists and others, come to see it because it's a complex event. Initiates are consecrated to the genie of the river, the spirit of the river that is protective of the village. And once they're consecrated, they come back to the village center and one by one enter a possession trance. And as the spirit of the genie mounts, this power mounts in their bellies, the initiates get into under the trance, feel this compulsion to stab themselves to release that power, that building power. And then the elders who have mastered this spiritual power, which is called Seke, use their mastery of it to heal the initiate's wounds instantaneously. So that's very spectacular because these wounds can be very deep. I've seen, you know, intestines coming, protruding from these bloodied wounds. And it's very, again, very energetic and hyper-masculine and violent. So when these wounds are, you know, a balm is placed on the wounds and the healing happens instantaneously, so it's just a puffy protrusion, which is quite amazing. And then in the afternoon, there's also a kind of exhibition of other spiritual uncanny powers. But because this execution of the stab is dangerous for the neophytes, and those initiates are very vulnerable in the possession trance, psychologically vulnerable as well as spiritually, physically, The women elders come out the night before and they set a snare for any witches who might be lurking or might want to harm the youths in their vulnerable state. So they perform egbiki, which is basically this rite, this nocturnal religious rite of anti-witchcraft at night, in the middle of the night. They strip naked, they slap their genitals to activate their own spiritual power, and they curse these, you know, would-be evildoers by pounding the ground with their pestles. And it's quite, of course, I haven't seen it because it's taboo to see. I've heard them do it, and their keening is chilling, and the pounding of the ground sounds like thunder in the night, and it is a chilling, menacing sound. So that was Dupree. Now, I knew of Dupree, and I knew of the women's right, but when I went into begin my investigation of Dupree, I was very surprised that Dupree, the villages now in the wake of the Civil War, were newly animated and peopled with, you know, refugees who'd come out of the bankrupt cities and who were back in the villages. Dupree had become even more grander in scale and more energetic. But as I interviewed the masters of Seke and the elders and notables of the villages about Dupree and the women's role, they kept saying to me, no, the women's right has nothing to do with Dupree. It's a whole separate affair. And I didn't understand at first, how could it be its own a separate affair? Wasn't this the kind of, because they protect the village by actually making those aspersions. They seal the village. Nobody's allowed to go in or come out for 24 hours while they conduct Dupree, because they've sealed the village with their magical protective force, and anybody who comes in will fall into the witch's trap. So it seems so absolutely essential to the whole enterprise of Dupree. I didn't understand how it had nothing, quote unquote, nothing to do with Dupree. But as I began to learn more and more, I realized that it was actually because the women, and I heard this over and over again, the women have a power that's stronger than anything. It's even stronger than Seke. It's stronger than the masters of Seke. It's stronger than witches. Their power is overriding. It's preeminent. It's predominant. They undertake this on their own initiative, whenever, not only at Dupree time, but whenever that community is threatened with evil. So, and then they reported to me that during that first civil war, when it first erupted, women took it upon themselves to perform the rite. Notably, there were 5 Baole women. The Baole are one of the main, most important of ethnic groups in Côte d'Ivoire, in the center of Côte d'Ivoire, and they are considered to be of the larger Akan group in West Africa. So 5 Baole women came out and performed the rite continuously to condemn the outbreak of the rebel forces that started the civil war. And actually those rebel soldiers understood exactly what the women were up to, because they were threatened by that, by the news that this rite was being performed against them. And they came into the village and they kidnapped the women and they abused and executed all of them except for the chief, female chief, who escaped. And so we know that was a rite called Ajanu, which, by the way, means between the legs. Very suggestive of where, from whence they were drawing their power. And then later still, as I was there and doing my investigation still of Dupree, I learned that women elders had stripped in broad daylight during public protests during the Civil War and against the state's immoral rulership. And so then I also learned that this was a long-standing tradition, the most famous of which in Côte d'Ivoire was in 1949. When Côte d'Ivoire was still a protectorate, a colony of the French, there was a multi-ethnic coalition of 2,000 women who marched from Abidjan to, which is a main city in the south, to Grand Bassam, which was a French colonial stronghold. And they gathered in front of the prison there where they were holding one of their national liberation leaders. And they performed Ajanu, this rite of female genital power, which confounded the French, who just saw them stripping, gesticulating lewdly in their view, hurling curses, singing, pounding pestles, brandishing branches. And to this day, there's still a statue commemorating the event in the center of Grand Bassam. They were seen as national heroines. So I began to, you know, thread the beads already and say, there is something more important here that I have to understand. So by the time I got back, I began to trace, you know, go to the library, do some research, trace these repeated executions of female genital power. Initially, I thought that it was limited to Côte d'Ivoire, to the region, the southern region. And of course, I found more and more evidence that not only was it beyond the reach of Côte d'Ivoire, extending from cases throughout West Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ghana, Togo, Benin, Nigeria, Cameroon. But I have found cases, and there are even videos online of such cases in Uganda and Kenya. So this is a very important history of Africa that I felt was not being told, not being highlighted, foregrounded as it needed to be because of its obvious import throughout history. I also started to found in my research that this, I was able to go back to documents of Arab travelers, to griots that documented female genital power back to the 13th century and extending all the way to the contemporary moment. So both ancient and widespread, this is a phenomenon that needed to be highlighted. And I knew I was onto something very big that needed to be both grounded in closely in the ethnographic field work that I had done to situate it in its most intimate framework of village life and religious worldview, where it's carried out and lived, and where it has also a kind of that important moral consonance and is not clearest, because also maybe the clearest to especially Western observers is its instantiation on the political scale, where women are manifesting politically. But again, I think that oftentimes those who read it, journalists and scholars who read those instances politically, miss the spiritual and religious significance, while those who read it as small religious idiosyncrasies of a people miss the wider import of this geographically, historically dispersed phenomenon, and also don't understand its very worldly power and how much it's informed the whole settlement of the region of West Africa, how polities were established, how ethnicities were founded. So its history is incredibly profound in all senses of the word.
So let's talk a little bit about that history, because I think going back a few centuries can help us ground our understanding of this practice. And you make this argument, and I think one of the books you must have encountered when you went to the library and that you engage with and build on is Igor Kapitov's thesis of the reproduction of African societies with the kind of frontier thesis. And so you connect his work, but you build on it to show how this rite connects many different societies who might have grown into different ethnic identities or different ethnic communities, but who share this kind of moral frontier source. And if you can explain that, because I found that to be something that was so illuminating.
Thank you. So the frontier thesis proposed by Igor Kopytov, and it's a book I think published in the 87, and was very groundbreaking, was about the dispersal of populations, how the region was settled in the 15th through 17th century, and taking account of how new polities, new ethnicities were forged on this, what was once a forest frontier, a still open expanse of the forest in territory that eventually a lot of what became Côte d'Ivoire. And what he was moving away from was this idea that ethnicity was always a bloodline, that it was timeless and went back time immemorial. You know, this kind of historyless idea about tribes that are very racially rooted, and to show that it's really the cultural expansion of that frontier. And it's the self-conscious construction of identity on that frontier. So he was also puzzled, though, by what were the principles on which people came together? How did they renegotiate their alliances? What is the common underlying substrate among the ethnicities that accounts for the very palpable cultural coherence of the region that everybody seems to feel is there, but no one can quite put their finger on? So my thesis is that what constitutes the core similarity isn't any structural principle, because there's a lot of heterogeneity in just Côte d'Ivoire alone, matrilineal societies, patrilineal societies, dual sex societies. There are societies with kings and queens. There are societies that are more self-governed. So what is it that, and there's so many different self-identified ethnicities. In Côte d'Ivoire alone, by common count, there are 60 ethnicities at the time of the founding of Côte d'Ivoire as a nation, as a modern nation. And now there are, you know, over 100 that have been counted now. So my thesis was that what constitutes this core similarity isn't any structural principle, but a more essential founding principle that dictates how relations with newcomers were negotiated, and that was according to the rules of the moral domain. And this is where my thesis of matrifocal morality comes in. So what I'm talking about by matrifocal morality is that in West Africa, the family, the nuclear family, the primary moral bond is between mother and child, not the trifecta of mother, father, child. That's not the nuclear family. So special obligations are always owed by a person to his or her siblings, the children born of the same womb. And that is true whether you are from a society, a matrilineal society or a patrilineal society. There's special matrifocal bond. And behind that is this principle that women are the preeminent, they are the first comers in humanity. They are the egg that the chicken that hatched the egg, you know. So, and also they have this innate spiritual power to access the spirits, like the genies of the rivers and so forth, to make moral pacts on which society can literally ground themselves on the land that is ultimately owned by the spirits. And so this idea of women are the first comers, the mothers are, the obligations to the mothers and children of the womb honor this principle of firstness that, you know, many anthropologists recognize is the principle that you owe, that newcomers owe allegiance to firstcomers. But the firstcomers were the women. So, you know, Kopytov, let me just finish this. Kopytov contends that, you know, gee, when people entered this moral, this forest frontier, sometimes they were freeing the fleeing kingdoms and slavery or other metropoles they had grievances with. They had new visions that they wanted to carry into their frontier when they wanted to establish new societies. There were reasons they left. Sometimes it was war. Sometimes it was moral infractions like adultery of a leader and a group splintered according to, you know, what sides they were on. But he said, you know, they were really entering a moral vacuum. So he was puzzling on what basis would they establish new alliances when they met other people, other migrants in this forest? And I again say that, you know, what they were recognizing is what they carried with them was the recognition that all political organization and all social structure had to be authorized first and foremost by spiritual power. And that was always inaugurated through woman as its primary source, and woman as the most effective mediator of spiritual power. And that also explained the tendency of frontier societies to remain stateless by design. This is another, you know, another big discussion we could have, but basically, you know, the West is very interested with the history of states, kingdoms, nation states, but in West Africa especially, stateless societies were often larger, more powerful, and they're certainly more predominant in number. And by stateless societies, I mean collective self-rule. So these are usually dual-sexed. There were men's societies and women's societies that each had their own prerogatives and business and leaderships and hierarchies. But they had a way of establishing an egalitarianism between them. And they, one of the ways that one of the most predominant ways that we see that this, that they maintained their structure is through age sets. So there would be a class, a generation that would be initiated around the age 20 of men, young men. And then through, a generation ages, they get promoted over the years. At each time they're promoted to another higher rank and greater responsibility. So they begin as warriors and then they become like counselors and judges and etc. until they retire. But very important part of that is that it's also the women's associations that authorize and empower these male age sets to protect them as, you know, as their military force. So both these age sets and the women are acting in defense of home. So I'll stop there because I don't want to ramble. I want to stay focused on what you see as the main lines of interest here and if I'm touching the right notes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, zucchini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
No, absolutely. This is, I think, giving us a better grounding of this concept. So one element that I also wanted you to develop for us is, I think there's been, and you make this point, a lot of, in some ways, distraction from female genital power because of a focus on the reproductive power of women.
Yes, yes.
But here, we're talking about postmenopausal women, women right. who do not have the reproductive power, and we're still talking about their genitals. And yet that's not the womb, which I think is right. something that we could gloss over, but is actually fundamental here. So what is it about the role that these women hold, their connection to the ancestors, and their moving past reproductive status that makes them these powerful guardians of morality? And then also I wanted to bring in here the discussion that you have in the book about how can we refer to their gender category? You say that right. Ifeoma Dume proposes a neuter category, but that doesn't satisfy you here.
This is important. I think that in terms of symbols, a ritual symbol, the body has pride of place. The ritual is made to be experienced in the body, and the body and it's the bodily places of power and the bodily effluvia. These are all powerful ritual symbols that are always leveraged to give ritual its energy, because ritual is made to be transformative. It's made to make something change. It's not holding hands and singing kumbaya. You know, it's not a good warm feeling. Ritual is, its intended purpose is to effect some kind of ontological, epistemological shift. And the genitals, of course, are the most powerful part of the body. They are generative. That's where, you know, the reproduction comes from. That's where, you know, the greatest energetic force, this innate energetic force, comes from and resides. So, and of course, reproductive power and the generative power is important and is critical. And motherhood in West Africa, of course, for women is an office. It does change a woman's social status. It is important. But what happens to women is that they have their postmenopausal life when they are no longer the child bearers. But what in this state, it's instead of it becoming a sexless state, according to the Western African conception, they are embodying a spiritual doubling, because they are inspired. They are their bodies are reflecting an actual sexual doubling, and they have a spiritual doubling. So, for example, when an old woman sprouts chin hairs, she's demonstrating her sort of bisexual nature. And in fact, in the famous Nigerian masking society and performances of Gelede, which are the celebration of the mothers, capital M, the office of these mothers, these postmenopausal women who are known to have spiritual power, they have two masks. One is a night bird, which is a bird that transforms itself like the witches at night. And the other is the bearded woman, which, you know, is also demonstrating the physical and spiritual doubling of a woman in postmenopause. In West Africa, this idea is that spiritual beings have power, but their power transcends any gender. So often primordial beings or the gods or spirits are sexually ambiguous, or they're shape-shifting, or they're twinned so that they are bigendered or supragendered. And so the postmenopausal women are these supragendered beings who are reflecting and channeling through their very bodies this innate power of this supranatural and supernatural power. And as I said, they're considered to be the living embodiment of the ancestors. By virtue of their age, they are closest to the departed, and the ancestors are considered not just dead, but of course living and living beings who are spiritually alive and attainable through ritual, who oversee the moral order. So the mothers are the most closely connected. They're still the living embodiment of those departed but living ancestors, the living dead. They are sort of very close. So their genitalia is this, as I said, like a living altar. Now, what I underscore is they're never making appeal to the womb or to their reproductive power per se. It is the fact, although they will say, they will recognize that they are, it's only reference to the degree that of the nature of the mother as the generative first. But it's something more than just that. You see, I'm not saying it's not that, but it's more than just maternity. It is now they're referring to their genitalia and their buttocks, which they also denude publicly in this public form of rebuke and shaming, to represent, this secret but sacred site of the moral foundations.
So maybe we can bring this discussion to some concrete examples of this practice. Yep. And you mentioned in the beginning, in 1949, the famous Women's March of Grand Bassam, but there have been so many cases documented, the Women's War in Nigeria, of this kind of protest that combines this worldly and spiritual power. And I think one thing that's so effective about your thesis is that it finally connects these events that have been kind of isolated in the historiography, but you give us a way of understanding how they link up. And I wonder how you came to see that and the work that you had to do to really elaborate those connections.
Right. So thank you so much for that appreciation. That's exactly what I tried to do, was connect the dots, string the beads of evidence, finding comparative cases and trying to see what was essentially common to them. So I when I first started to do the research, the library research to find some common cases, of course, one of the first I came across was the so-called Women's War in Nigeria in 1929, which was a series of uprisings among the Igbo and Ibibio women in southeastern Nigeria. And they were manifesting against an impending British taxation of women's property. So that itself is important, because you see that it's not just generally an uprising against colonialism. It was very particularly focused against the unjust taxation of women's property, the lack of respect and acknowledgement of their own purview, their own independent purview. And this points to something that was very important to me. That is that I think that I, along with many Westerners, you know, originally had the notion that, you know, everywhere women in Africa were subjugated to male domination and, you know, were never really had much freedom. But in fact, as this book demonstrates completely, that's not true. And in fact, the history of colonialism and development and post-colonialism and statehood has been a system, a history of the systematic loss for women of a lot of power, structural and spiritual, to the degree that this kind of power is increasingly being subjugated, a subjugated history. So at the time in 1929, thousands of women showed up at the Native administration centers dressed in the same unusual way. They were wearing short loincloths, which, as you know, especially back then, was, you know, already a kind of a violation of the norms of society. Their faces were smeared with charcoal or ashes. They were carried so-called weapons, and like their heads were wreathed in ferns symbolizing war. They had sticks or ferns or palms that they would brandish and that they would use to invoke the power of the female ancestors. And then all of this while hurling threats and curses at these violators of their rights. So that was, I guess it was Judith Van Allen, who was back in around 78, wrote a very seminal article that also triggered others to consider what was common among some of these actually pretty common colonial uprisings among women. All too often, I found that these were kind of written off as women's auxiliaries of the largely male led nationalist revolutions against colonialism. And I say written off because I think they failed to take seriously the degree to which this was true spiritual warfare. It wasn't just symbolic. And it was also doesn't acknowledge the degree to which the women themselves took it upon themselves as their own separate agents to, you know, demonstrate their agency and militate for their own interests in the same context. So they were parallel struggles and complementary struggles, not auxiliary struggles. So there are many, many cases that I was able to find, document, and trace throughout West Africa. And let me see if I can think of some of them. One of them was in Cameroon. There's the case of Anlu, which was a women's society as well as a right. And etymologically, Anlu meant to drive away. And it was categorized as this women's collective disciplinary technique that would be employed against, again, any man who insulted a woman's genitals or who committed an offense of a sexual nature against a woman. And what they would do is they'd sing and dance and they'd proceed against the offender's compound where they'd pour urine or excreta, and then these vulgar, so-called vulgar parts of the body were exhibited as they chanted and so forth. But it was used also, again, in protest against the colonial leaders. Also in Cameroon, there was another women's society called the Takumbeng, and they would perform that same rite, but also very overtly in political protest. So there were these postmenopausal women, again, very singularly identified that they were postmenopausal, who would expose their genitals, defecate, urinate, etc. And let me think. Another example was in colonial Togo. The Uwe women, I think they pronounce it Uwe, infuriated at the arrest of their local leader in the resistance, the colonial resistance, drew on the voodoo tradition, which includes a form of female genital power. So the market women would move through the city of Lome, kind of gathering force as they congregated and mobilized, and they eventually congregated outside of a prison. This is much like in Côte d'Ivoire. And they were marching and singing, and they chastised and threatened the French and the African collaborators, showing themselves naked before the police and security forces as a means of cursing them. And I should say that, you see, one of the points that I make repeatedly throughout the book, especially in the last part of the book, that is on the politics, is on the efficacy of these rites. They are this belief in the profound power of the mothers still has salience in the contemporary social imaginary. I mean, people believe that this is dangerous to see, to ignore, to, they take it seriously. And so much so that armed forces are known to flee and just turn and move away when they do this. And there are, I refer to a video that I found online of contemporary Togolese women who are stripping right in front of the armed forces who just turn and leave. You know, it's very powerful.
You ask yourself in the end of your book this question, you know, about efficacy and if this is a practice that can still be seen or be read.
Yeah.
By young people, say, who come to the city, grow up in the city, and maybe don't even, haven't ever been to the village that their family might come from and who maybe would be distant from these practices. And yet you show something quite remarkable in a very inventive way of asking this question.
Thanks. You know, because this is, well, I should, let me preface this by saying that a lot of the part three that's really on the focuses on the contemporary political instantiations of this, especially in Côte d'Ivoire during the two periods of the two civil wars there and the decade between from 2002 to 2011. So it was obvious that women were demonstrating in the streets and that this very spectacular, shocking, you know, spontaneous ritual would regularly happen in the context of these wider protests and women's marches that would be happening to rebuke the both sides, both the government forces and the rebels. But I wondered, you know, were the young people appreciating this? Was this generally recognized, or was this somehow still a vestigial work and, you know, something that only older people could recognize? Was it some kind of pathetic appeal to a bygone day when people still believed that these things were truly efficacious? But what I did, even though I'm not a sociologist and I didn't believe that there would be any kind of, you know, valid sociological sampling size, I did go into very, very big high school in Abidjan and designed and distributed a survey to a number of classes, about 100 young people. Average age between like 17 and 20, 21, who would, about gestures, what ritual gestures, what kind of iconography in West African art, like a kneeling woman holding her breast, you know, what that meant to them. And I was surprised to find that even in very urban metropole like Abidjan, which is very ethnically heterogeneous, where now generations have been born to people of mixed ethnicity, where many of them have never been back to the ancestral village, where many don't even speak an African language anymore, shockingly still to me, that they still understood by and large, the meaning, the significance of these gestures. And the other thing that I did was I also did the same, what's the word in English? I'm thinking sondage.
Survey,
thank you. The survey in the villages, especially among the youth that were there, either just watching or participating in Dipri and the Adrikru version of Dipri. So, of course, I expected that they would have a higher degree of understanding, and by and large, they did. I mean, they had a, like 100% understanding of what that was all about. But, you know, I was surprised and that they did. The other thing subsequent to that, after I came home, was I was aware of and included in my book reactions to these videos online of women performing female genital power. Reactions, by and large, of the youth, because they're the ones online. They're the ones with access to computers and using the media these days. And very interesting dialogues between among these young Africans to the spectacle. Some are embarrassed, saying, "Oh my God, don't let this be on CNN. This is just another image of Africa's backwardness." And others who would correct them and say, no, you don't understand. My grandmother has told me about this. She's even participated in this. This is what it means. It's a sacred power. It's important. This is a profound and intimate rebuke. And it's serious business. And when women strip, you know, people take notice. So one of the most famous examples, that well-known examples is that maybe listeners will recognize, is the Liberian leader, Gbowee. She's won a Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, for her work in Liberia. She was leading an inter-ethnic coalition of women for over 14 years during the Liberian civil wars, trying to end the wars. So ultimately, you know, the women were holding vigils and, you know, marshaling their moral power to enjoin the men to end the violence that was just a reprehensible violation of the moral order. And eventually they came to peace talks in Ghana, overseen by a Nigerian statesman. But once they got to Ghana, the women, you know, took it upon themselves to go by bus to just be there as a force to hold vigil and to vigilantly monitor the undertakings of the peace negotiations. And when they got there, they realized that the men weren't taking it very seriously. They were luxuriating in the hotels where they were being put up and being fed nicely, and negotiations had stalled. So the women were fed up. They held a sit-in, linking arms outside the hotel. And so what happened was the authorities were called to disperse the women and to arrest Gbowee. And she was so outraged. And she said, "I am going to strip. I'm going to strip right here." And so the chief statesman who was leading the negotiations came out, calmed her, sent the forces away, the police away, and begged the restraint of the mothers, and went back in, and lo and behold, a peace treaty was negotiated. I have heard that scene was filmed and is documented in a documentary of well-known one called Pray the Devil Back to Hell. And I've had many people tell me since they heard about my book that now they understand that scene. They didn't understand why it was that, you know, her simple threat to strip kind of evinced such an effective reaction. But now, once you understand the power of matrifocal morality, the power of this threat of female genital power, you understand the scene.
And I think that's something to keep in mind about this book is that on the one hand, it takes us back hundreds of years to understand the origins of this deep-seated moral principle. But at the same time, it comes very close to the present. And it has real implications, your thesis, for conflict resolution today, and particularly in the context of the civil conflict in Côte d'Ivoire and this landscape of extreme sexual violence that accompanied that conflict.
Yes. So I, again, in the third part of the book that looks at violation and deployment, I was giving this contemporary context to my study. So I was recognizing that civil war, which has been a kind of a plague in Africa for a generation now, that broke out in Côte d'Ivoire, where for some it was least expected because Côte d'Ivoire was, as I said, such a heterogeneous community or nation, I should say, that had managed to negotiate different claims for so long, actually splintered. And in the course of this bloody violence, the populace was not spared. In fact, they were horribly victimized. And women were particularly targeted. Sexual violence, horrendous sexual violence, was rampant on both sides. And I make the point that I think, you know, rape has always been a weapon of war everywhere, and maybe more and more so as civilian populaces have been not left out of the fray of the battlefield. They're very much caught in the crosshairs of the battlefield, especially in civil war. But what makes it more poignant, especially in this area where matrifocality has been this predominant force, has been this guiding principle of civility and peace and alliances and identity building, to violate a woman's body, to violate the matriline, to putrefy it with rape and the bastard children that come from rape, to cause the shame and the humiliation not only of the women but the families that have been made to watch or participate, the communities that have been torn asunder by this violation, this gross violation of this, you know, most intimate and sacred, sacrosanct space, is, you know, particularly poignant and horrible. And then I also featured the many calls that the way that women were not just the victims, though, because then I feature the many ways in which they interceded in the course of protests, public protests against the war, against the forces, against many things. But among other things, the Ivorian women formed unions of women victims of war unions, and they demanded to be held that the government, that the forces on both sides be held accountable, and that there be indemnification of their pain and suffering. And one of the things that I did see on YouTube that I thought was very poignant was when some of the women belonging to this women's union for the indemnification that had been promised to them by the Peace and Truth and Reconciliation Committee of the nation following the Second Civil War. This is now the war ended in 2011. This is now 2015. Some of the elder women were gathered outside and they were demanding that there no longer be a stalled release of the list of women who were going to be indemnified and what they were to receive and who was to receive it. And authorities came and armed guards tried to chase them away by force. And at this point, the women elders just start shrieking and stripping. And one woman strips down and bends down on her hands and knees in the position of childbirth, as, you know, the mothers in both senses of the word, to evict this, to evince this curse, out of moral outrage, and making this intimate rebuke and this appeal to her genital power to make the most profound veto of what's happening. It's kind of an absolute it's an absolute performance of absolute outrage and an absolute appeal to the absolute authority to intercede. It is quite powerful.
It's a remarkable story. The title, An Intimate Rebuke, can you tell us where that came from and how you decided upon that as its title?
Yes, I actually, the phrase I borrowed from the British Africanist John Lonsdale, whose work as an anthropologist is on East Africa, and it's very different from mine, but he writes eloquently, and in his eloquence always kind of elicits imaginative ideas for me. So, for example, one seminal idea he had was that, the public history of Africa is usually conducted from the top down, as I said before, about kings and states and so forth, and wars and battles. But, you know, it's not just the focus of the state but history has also been framed in terms of what he called the crude designations of historical periods, like pre-colonial, colonial, post-colonial. And that's always a narrative in which the West figures, you know, as a determining agent. So he was suggesting that what might be more indicative for understanding the significance of Africa's past in African terms is to look in what he calls the gaps, things that have been obscured because we've been so preoccupied with those features. And along the way, in the context of him discussing that, here is this quote that I came upon, and I wrote it down so I would, you know, in anticipation of this question. He wrote that insight might be intelligible not only within a cultural tradition, but potentially standing some critical distance apart from it, a confirmation of a conventional practice, but also a startling reinterpretation. An intimate rebuke. So when I read that passage, I knew I'd found my title. And in fact, I wrote to Lonsdale to thank him for the inspired phrase, and he was very surprised because he wasn't writing about anything related to women, to women's history, certainly not to female genital power. So he was surprised, but he was also glad and that I had made this unique application of his phrase to the subject. And I found it, you know, particularly inspiring. You know, to me, it applied in two ways. One is that the mother's ritual appeal to the genitals reveals this most intimate and vulnerable part of the female body as this secret and sacred source of their power, and that they activate it by appealing to that living altar, their embodied living altar, to curse those who violate the moral mandates. So that's the intimacy of the body, and the way that, but also the rebuke is also intimate in that it's first of all, it expresses a right that I call local knowledge. It's that is uniquely African reflection on the sources of all legitimate power. And it's a uniquely African form of critique of their own societies. So when the mothers intervene to condemn their chiefs, their kings, and now their presidents, their curse is a powerful critique. And I was seeing that when they conduct the rite of female genital power in public, these women elders are standing also It's intimate because they're critiquing their own society, but they're also standing at a critical distance apart, you know, quote unquote, from those regimes that supposedly are there to represent them, but that have obscured them, that have suppressed their power, that are doing no better than the colonials and, you know, and sidelining them and certainly not allowing them to represent their own interests. And they're condemning that leadership for forgetting this fundamental spiritual underpinning of all legitimate authority, which I say, you know, the governments in Africa forget to their own at their own peril. And I think that's where we all might have something to learn from the women. You know, this isn't a prescriptive book. You know, nobody, no scholar has the right to make prescriptions for other people in there. And also, I also make a conscious decision to avoid any comparative leaps out of Africa, you know, draw any hasty analogies between female genital power in Africa and women's naked protests in the West, like Femen or other, because I think that those kinds of surface parallels are not going to illuminate the true nature of the African case, which I was most interested in. But, you know, I can't help but say that today, right now, in the United States, we've had two powerful movements bottom up. The Me Too movement, this collective public performance of rage, when women are truly condemning the immorality and throwing off the mantle of male subjugation, that is a very charged moment in our political history and our moment of cultural upheaval in which the subject of women's moral outrage and how women demand respect and accountability, you know, is very timely. And also now, of course, the Black Lives Matter demonstrators are filling the streets of American cities and calling for true justice for all citizens. And again, we see that the power of a timely performative demand, you know, because that's what these demonstrations are, they're performative demand that authority and power be grounded in morality in order to have any legitimacy. So I think that the mother's message and the Black Lives Matter's message is just the same. No justice, no peace. So, you know, I'm hoping that these consonances will raise in my readers and your listeners' interest in this courageous and singular expression of African power and this manifestation of female genital power as a very courageous stand for peace grounded in justice.
A beautiful, beautifully phrased sentiment. So as we reach the end, I wondered, what is the next project that you're working on?
I have two. One is a very short piece that I haven't yet started to write, but I've started to research. And it's very much related. And that is, it's called, an article going to be called Catching Bullets with Buttocks, the quote-unquote obscene African power of Queen Nanny of the Jamaican Maroons. So Queen Nanny was a 17th century legendary leader of the Jamaican Windward Maroons, which was a community of formerly enslaved Africans who escaped to the hills. And under her leadership, they successfully repelled repeated attempts by British colonizers to recapture and subdue them, to the degree that eventually they were forced to sign a peace treaty with them. And so they got land rights that were granted to them in perpetuity, and there's still a Nanny town today. So Nanny's political heroism is recognized and has been celebrated. In fact, she's, you know, on the currency in Jamaica. Her image is on her currency. But what's equally renowned, but, you know, remains very confounding, is that she has this legendary sort of magical religious power. She reputedly stopped these incursions of the British by catching bullets with her buttocks and sending them back to lethal effect. And also she would boil cauldrons without using any kind of fire. And It would ward off, the British couldn't find them. It would make them get lost in the forest. These are things that I've heard about in Africa. And so drawing on my book, An Intimate Rebuke, I'm going to argue that this African-born nanny, she was of the Ashanti people in Ghana, was deploying this ancient ritual knowledge to strengthen the moral community of the Maroons and, you know, send back the enemy and evict evil and protect the village. So, and to reveal like the profound spiritual significance as a living ancestor. And the word for living ancestor in Ghana is Nana. And of course she was called Nanny. So, I think the links are clear, and I'm going to try and, you know, unearth these buried artifacts of her activity and to make the connections to reassert the tenacious potency of this African religious engagement even in the diaspora. The other longer project and that I've been working on for a while is a memoir. It's a memoir on another set of research that I did in Côte d'Ivoire on divination. And I wrote my dissertation on divination in West Africa, but went to do field work, postdoctoral field work after I graduated the University of Chicago. But I never managed to merge the two to write an academic book. Instead, it began to evolve into memoir because my encounters with diviners were profound and uncanny. I felt like I was doing less and less field work and more field work on my soul, because the diviners, of course, didn't want to talk about their practice. They wanted to show me, and I had become the subject of their study. So in order to talk about the degree to which they were effective, insightful, and uncanny, I had to do some revelation about what it was they had seen. So it began to be the story of my first marriage that they saw and were commenting on, and the story of how one inevitably gets changed in the so-called field, that it, you know, of course, we've long recognized that there's no such thing as objectivity anymore. And we academics have been granted more and more liberty and permission to allow for and even celebrate subjectivity and reflexivity in our work so that we can write ourselves in. But this was a story that I felt even went beyond those blurred genres, and I began to study and enjoy creative nonfiction and that kind of writing. So I've written this memoir. It's still yet to be edited and finally completed, but I hope to do that soon. So that memoir is called Ask for the Road. And very encouragingly, an excerpt from that work just won an award from the Society for Humanistic Anthropology, the 2019 Fiction and Creative Nonfiction Writing Contest, and it's just been published in the June issue of Anthropology and Humanism. It's called The Boiling Cauldron, which speaks a little bit to Nanny and her boiling cauldron. So you can see these overlapping interests.
Well, we very much look forward to reading the memoir. And we hope that we can have another conversation when that book comes out.
Oh, I'd love that. That would be wonderful. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Laura.
Thank you, Alyssa. It's been really energizing. And I hope I've done justice to the book and at least inspired people to read it. And I really feel earnest about doing justice to these brave women and their repeated call for justice. And I think their bravery, their vision needs to be better known. And so I do hope that people will read An Intimate Rebuke.
Hear, hear. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.